KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Presidential aide Elon Musk posted receipts claiming $55 billion in federal spending cuts. Our correspondent found they add up to a small fraction of that. We bring receipts on Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we meet a federal worker who was fired on President's Day. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. If you want to find out about someone, talk to his barber, which is what our correspondent did to get a picture of the new leader of Syria. Also, Hamas releases bodies of hostages for the first time since a ceasefire went into effect. And the New Year's morning attack in New Orleans means higher security bills for Carnival. It's Thursday, February 20th. This day in 1905, the Supreme Court upheld the legality of a vaccine mandate in Massachusetts. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russian President Vladimir Putin is weighing in on this week's talks between U.S. and Russian officials in Saudi Arabia. These mark the first high-level communication between Washington and Moscow since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began nearly 3 years ago. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Speaking to state media while touring a drone factory in St. Petersburg, Putin praised the U.S.-Russian meeting as a first step towards restoring relations between the two countries. Putin also said he would gladly meet with President Trump, but that it may take time for both administrations to prepare, adding the leaders weren't meeting just to drink tea, but find solutions acceptable to both sides over Ukraine and other issues. The budding U.S.-Russian detente marks a sharp departure from Biden-era efforts to isolate Moscow over its full-scale invasion of its neighbor. It has also unnerved Ukraine and traditional American allies in Europe who fear being sidelined from negotiations that determine their future. Charles Maines, NPR News.
A federal judge held a hearing yesterday to review the Justice Department's request to drop federal corruption charges against New York City Democratic Mayor Eric Adams. Several federal prosecutors have resigned over the matter. They allege the Trump administration is willing to end the case in exchange for Adams' help on immigration efforts. Trump officials and Adams deny the allegations. NPR's Brian Mann was in the courtroom for the hearing held by Judge Dale Ho.
Judge Ho acknowledged he has limited authority here. A DOJ request of this kind is normally a slam dunk. It's more or less rubber stamped by the courts. But yesterday, the judge made it clear he thinks this case really is different. This is a very complicated situation, at least from where I sit, Ho said. And so at the end of the hearing, he declined to offer a quick ruling. He says he needs more time to sort through this, but he promised a ruling soon.
NPR's Brian Mann reporting. A Senate panel questioned Labor Secretary nominee Lori Chavez de Remer yesterday about her views on labor unions, as well as the minimum wage and more. NPR's Joe Hernandez has more.
Chavez de Remer is a former Republican congresswoman from Oregon. While in Congress, she co-sponsored legislation called the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to unionize. Under questioning from Republicans, Lori Chavez de Remer called the legislation imperfect and said she supported the ability of states to pass right-to-work laws, which limit union efforts. Asked by Democrats whether she thought the federal minimum wage should be increased, Chavez de Remer said she recognized it hadn't been raised in over 15 years, but that some jurisdictions might need to have a different minimum wage than others. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
This week, President Trump said he is moving to impose tariffs of 25% or higher on more foreign imports. Yesterday, he said he wanted to put tariffs on imported lumber, too. Trump says it could start in early April. This is NPR. Civil rights groups are suing the Trump administration over executive orders they call illegal. As NPR's Sandia Dirks reports, the Legal Defense Fund and Lambda Legal are suing on behalf of three nonprofits.
The nonprofits provide housing, work programs, and medical care to Black, queer, and trans communities. The lawsuit claims the Trump administration, by banning anything it labels diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trans people, violates the right to free speech and due process and prevents the nonprofits from helping those disproportionately impacted by systemic racism and bigotry. Lambda Legal CEO Kevin Jennings says the consequences of the president's president's orders are more than just overturning decades of civil rights.
If people cannot get preventative care, if people cannot get care once they have HIV, people will die.
Trump has said his executive actions are about doing away with programs that he calls discriminatory. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is also suing the Trump administration. The bishops allege the administration has illegally stopped funding refugee resettlement programs, and they claim this violates the constitutional provision that gives Congress the power of the purse. The Vatican says that Pope Francis remains in the hospital. He's being treated for a case of severe pneumonia. Vatican officials say he got out of bed today, and that recent blood tests show some slight improvement in his condition. Francis was visited yesterday by Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni. She found him alert and responsive and says he has not lost his sense of humor. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, some people mark Black History Month by reading books aloud together.
First, though, the Trump administration has posted a new online tracker that describes what it says are the dollars saved by the Department of Government Efficiency.
That's the cost-cutting effort championed by Elon Musk and President Trump. Musk made a stream of claims on social media in recent weeks about big savings. A Doge website kept promising receipts, and this week the website published some, and the numbers add up to less than claimed.
NPR Stephen Fowler did the math. He is here with us now to tell us what he found. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Okay, so what does this online Doge document claim to track?
So Monday, a savings page on doge.gov went live. It says there's been savings so far of $55 billion. What's included in that? Doge says things like, quote, fraud detection, deletion, workforce reductions, programmatic changes, and regulatory savings. Exactly how those changes fit into the overall savings estimate is still TBD. They promise to keep adding more information. What we do have shared for now is a list of some of the government contracts Doge says were canceled in recent days, what they call a wall of receipts that adds up to about $16 billion in alleged savings.
Important to note here that Elon Musk, the tech mogul, and also I want to point out a government contractor who heads up this group, insists that the work is transparent. So two questions here. Is it transparent? And now that you've been reviewing these contracts, how do their numbers stack up with what you have found?
The Doge website, Michelle, is actually less transparent about these contracts than other public government data sources. So I had to search through 130,000 plus contracts that have been changed from January 20th to Monday to see if I could match them up with what Doge shared. But the claims weren't off by just a little bit, but rather overstated by billions. Half of these savings claimed in these receipts comes from what Doge said was actually a typo entered into the federal contract database a few years ago that made a listing worth up to $8 million look like like $8 billion. That typo was fixed in the system a few weeks ago, but only fixed on the Doge website yesterday. I will note here, Doge has not responded to multiple requests from NPR to get clarity about their process.
Okay, well, that's a pretty big typo, Stephen. Okay, so what about the rest of the claims?
Here's three big things I found. One, more than half of the contracts listed haven't actually been canceled yet. Two, a third of the entries don't actually result in any savings by Doge's own accounting. These are contracts that were already maxed out and couldn't see any more spending in the future. Three, the terminations I could verify only add up to about $2 billion saved, mainly through cuts that accompany the attempted dismantling of the Education Department, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and USAID.
Okay, so a purported $55 billion in savings shrinks to $16 billion, which upon further examination you found is just $2 billion. Well, one could argue that's still a lot of money, though.
Well, for you or me or even a nice business, yes. But the federal government spent more than $6.7 trillion with a T and a lot more zeros in the last fiscal year. Here's Jessica Riedel with the Manhattan Institute. She studied ways to cut wasteful spending from the budget from a conservative policy perspective.
It has to be done legally through Congress, and it has to be done competently by people who understand federal budget and accounting. And what Musk and Doge are doing is more cosmetic symbolic changes that won't save money but might sound good.
Basically, Riedel says any meaningful cuts to federal spending has to come from Congress having hard debates over how to do it.
Quickly, Stephen, if meaningful savings have to be achieved through difficult conversations in Congress and the Doge effort isn't actually saving much money, what is the point?
Well, it's not about pinching pennies. It's about a manifestation of President Trump's overarching vision to remake the federal government by making it a lot smaller and a lot more aligned with his worldview.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
The cuts to the government are a matter of money and also of people. Layla sat down yesterday with one federal employee who was fired on President's Day.
Even before my interview with Alex Heimowitz started, as we were chatting and checking mic levels, it was clear his life had been upended.
What'd you have for breakfast, Alex? She just needs to get a level.
Mic check. I had coffee.
You had coffee?
Yeah, I can't keep anything down right now.
Oh, no. Are you anxious?
More than you can ever imagine.
Really?
Yeah. Filed for unemployment yesterday, so... It's tough. Everything right now is just really bad.
Heimowitz is 29. He's a lawyer, and he recently left his high-paying corporate job for a life in public service as a presidential management fellow. It's a prestigious program created under President Jimmy Carter to attract the best and brightest minds into federal work across the government. But once President Trump was sworn into office and talk of mass layoffs began, fear started spreading.
There was conversation about people being let go. There was conversation about investigations, you know, ending. And it was pretty obvious that probationary employees were under the gun. And it felt like just a matter of time before it was going to happen to me.
And what type of work were you doing?
So my office, I worked at a specific sub-agency at the USDA that was designed to help ensure cattle ranchers and cattlemen were getting paid, meatpackers were paying on time. And my specific role was to work on the antitrust issues. And the idea was to create rules to protect small meatpackers, poultry growers, farmers, and the consumer.
Who's doing that now?
No one. At least the antitrust part.
Walk me through what happened when you found out you were terminated. Did anybody ever interview you? Were people in the building looking for things to cut?
So my parents had come for the weekend because they had seen some of the news going on about probationary employees getting cut. We just kind of hang out, go out for lunch, and I get a text message from one of my coworkers saying that she received a letter. So I went to go check my email. I didn't get anything. And then Sunday night, it's around 10 o'clock, I see an email come in from an email address that I had never seen before. It is a blank email with a PDF file that just reads, notice of termination.
And what did it say?
That I was being let go for performance and for not meeting the mission of the agency.
Did you have any bad performance reviews?
I had no performance reviews, and I was holding back tears. My immediate supervisor was distraught. I think it was a combination of people not knowing how to process it on my behalf and also not knowing how to process it on their own behalves.
What protections do you have? What are you going to do? Do you have any?
You know, I've said that, you know, potentially starting some kind of class action lawsuit on behalf of PMFs, whether or not it actually goes through, I've already started making calls to some of the law firms that, you know, I worked with, but it just feels wrong just sitting and waiting for, you know, the appeals board to say whether or not my job was properly cut.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to sit idly by.
Let's say this decision gets reversed. Mm-hmm. Let's say the administration changes and they make different decisions about future employment. Would you go back to public service?
Probably not. At the end of the day, I want to help people. My direct supervisor told me that we were going to work on novel ideas. We were going to keep food prices down. We were going to help ranchers make sure that they were getting paid on time. We were going to help, you know, break up some of the issues in consolidation at the top of the meatpacking and poultry world. And to help do that would have been incredible. And when you spend your whole life wanting to do something just for it to be ripped away from you with a nondescript letter, doesn't make you want to go back to the place that just ripped that away from you.
Alex Heimowitz is formerly with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Several hours after he spoke with Layla, the president issued a new executive order and cut the Presidential Management Fellows program that Heimowitz had joined.
It's Black History Month, and some people are celebrating by reading books together.
The African American reading gives me joy. It's a place of community.
Tanya Perry is president of the National Council of Teachers of English.
In 1990, the group launched annual gatherings where authors and others read out loud about the African American experience. More than 6 million people have participated.
We share together in the reading of the literature, and everyone brought to the table their own experience and their own ability to understand and ask questions. And everyone is welcome to that table.
Perry is also the provost at Miles College, which is a historically Black institution in Fairfield, Alabama.
Having an opportunity to hear the perspective of diverse peoples is very important to the fabric of our country. And everyone playing a role in our history, it just allows all of our students to have access to understanding all of our diversity, all of the peoples who make our country the country that it is.
Carol Boston Weatherford is a professor and award-winning author of more than 80 books for young people.
Children gravitate toward books where characters look like them and are touched by books where the characters look like them. All children deserve to see themselves in books. And of course, seeing yourself in a book makes you want to read more.
Weatherford also brings the read-ins to her students.
Knowing your history is valuable, is powerful. You can't take it to the bank, but you can't lose it in the stock market either. Once you know it, no one can ever take it away from you.
Jacqueline Woodson, who wrote Brown Girl Dreaming, says the experience holds special meaning this year.
I think the attempted erasure of Black history and so many histories in this country is very, of course, intentional, right? Because if we don't know where we come from, we won't know where we're going, and we won't know how to not repeat the mistakes of the past.
Some of Weatherford and Woodson's books have been banned or challenged, but Woodson persists.
No one can steal our stories, right? If we're not writing the stories down, we're going to be telling the stories. If we're not telling the stories, we're going to be singing the stories. We're going to be dancing the stories.
If you're interested, you can find suggested books online at ncte.org. This is NPR News. Mm-hmm.
The next fresh air, Rich Benjamin, whose maternal grandfather was president of Haiti in 1957, but after 19 days was overthrown by a military coup. We'll talk about getting classified documents showing America's role in the coup, and hear about Benjamin's experiences as a black, gay, Haitian American who came out during the AIDS epidemic. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We follow up this morning on a story that was in the headlines weeks ago, which is a thing we do consistently on this program. It's a story from New Orleans, which needs more security for its parades at carnival season because of the New Year's Day Bourbon Street attack. It's an added cost that organizers of smaller events find hard to cover. Here's Drew Hawkins from the Gulf States Newsroom.
Greetings from the intergalactic crew of Chewbacca's. It's a sci-fi and fantasy-themed Mardi Gras parade with dozens of small groups, each with their own theme. One group hands out decorated forks for the Twilight-themed crew of Twihards, which member Kayla Mendow explains...
As an homage to the city of Forks, which is the setting of Twilight.
Chewbacca's captain, Simonette Barry, or her official title...
Overlord Apocalypse Meow.
Says that sense of community is a huge part of the carnival season, and it's more important than ever.
We can't let things like the Bourbon Street attack stop the joy that we find in each other and in the culture of parading and celebration.
Because of the attack, New Orleans is requiring parades to have more police. The city covers these costs for larger, more traditional parades, but independent walking crews like Chewbacca's that march through different neighborhoods have to pay for it themselves.
These are regular New Orleanians. You know, they're school teachers. They might be retired.
Yvonne Garrett is captain of Crew de Vue, another walking parade. She says they also should be supported by the city. New Orleans City Council President J.P. Morrell agrees and is working to change the city's code. Right now, only parades with large economic impacts get free security.
Those walking troops do not go along traditional Mardi Gras routes. So for some of those businesses, they literally count on that infusion of people for the year.
Chewbacca's security bill was $45,000 this year, double what they paid last year. The city stepped up to cover the extra costs. It's a temporary solution, so the parade could roll as planned. Officials haven't said how much extra they're paying for security this Mardi Gras to make sure people can stay safe and laissez le bon temps rouler. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
The coalition of Syrian rebel fighters that deposed the regime of Bashar al-Assad was led by a man who grew up in a well-to-do neighborhood in Syria's capital. NPR's Emily Fang and Jawad Rizala went to Damascus to find out more.
The neighborhood is prosperous, clean swept streets with stately apartment buildings and spacious balconies. It is the perhaps unlikely place where the militant fighter who is now Syria's de facto leader spent his formative years. Ahmed al-Sharaa is now claimed as a hometown hero here. NPR's repeated requests for an interview with him went unanswered, and so we decided to talk to those who once knew him. Barber Mohammed Ogli says he cut Sharaa's hair until he went away to Damascus University to study media. In fact, all the Sharaa men used to come here, his father and his brother. Sharaa was a calm child and quiet, Ogli says. He only spoke when asked a question. He had no inkling the future Sharaa would move to Iraq and become an Islamist fighter with an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group, and later be detained in American prisons for 5 years until 2011. Ogli says he only found out about that version of Sharaa when one day he saw the boy whose hair he used to cut on television. By then, Sharaa was a militant leader in Syria. He'd formed a group that managed to take control over parts of northern Syria, and last December, they overthrew Assad. As much as Sharaa is celebrated by his former neighbors, they are also a bit bewildered by him. This is Mohammed Shukri, an imam. He mentored a teenage Sharaa at the local mosque, an experience several people Sharaa grew up with told us turned him into the deeply observant Muslim he is today. But even the imam says he was surprised by Sharaa. Surprised, the imam says, because he personally taught Sharaa a moderate version of Islam common in Syria, an Islam that is open to everyone of all backgrounds. But he admits Sharaa may have been exposed to more extremist ideas when he went to Iraq. And while Sharaa was gone, this neighborhood in Syria changed too under the Assad regime. Shukri, the imam, says Sharaa's father was progressive and stubborn. He was allegedly fired from the fuel ministry for complaining about bribery under the old regime. Abdullah Labadi is the next-door neighbor to Sharaa's parents. He says they were then evicted from their apartment, and their home, just across the hall from his, was given to a regime official and his family.
The old Assad regime, they give their officers other people's houses.
But Labadi says last December, after the regime fell, they came back to reclaim their old apartment. They still do not live there permanently, but Nabil al-Muhammad, a doorman working nearby, said they swung by recently, and he and Sharaa's father had a coffee together. They made small talk and refrained from talking about politics. Steps away, Lama Karkutli is unloading several large suitcases from a car. She tells us she left Syria from Michigan during the Civil War, but is now back to visit this new Syria now that her neighbor helped topple the former regime.
We want to celebrate here. Really enjoy Damascus.
I feel like that your neighbor is now the new leader of Syria almost.
No, we are proud of this.
Everyone is trying to claim a piece of Sharaa now. Their lives, they say, changed by his actions, even if no one has seen more than a glimpse of him in the last 2 decades. Except for Mohammed Ogli, the barber. Last December, newly victorious in his taking of Damascus, Sharaa paid a visit to his former hairdresser for old time's sake. Ogli said Sharaa came without an entourage and without an appointment. He hopes this Sharaa, the version who pulls no favors and waits in line with everyone else, will be good for Syria. But right now, he has very little to base that on. Just hope. Emily Fang, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
We know the saying, there are a lot of fish in the sea. But just how many fish? Well, we asked one scientist.
We really don't know how many fish there are in the sea. And we don't know how those numbers fluctuate year after year.
But they're getting a better sense of fish populations in deep, dark ocean waters by turning to elephant seals for answers. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is escalating his criticism of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. On social media yesterday, Trump referred to Zelensky as a dictator, a day after Trump falsely suggested Ukraine started the war with Russia. As NPR's Lexi Schapitl reports, some Senate Republicans are distancing themselves from the president's comments.
A group of Republican senators are reiterating their support for Ukraine, including North Carolina's Tom Tillis, who was in Ukraine just days ago to mark the third anniversary of Russia's invasion. He says he's concerned about anything that suggests a moral equivalency between Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin.
He's a very bad person, needs to be stopped. He's going to metastasize across Europe if we don't.
Democrats, meanwhile, slammed Trump for his comments, saying he's parroting Russian propaganda. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, the Capitol.
Trump's special U.S. envoy to Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, was in Kyiv yesterday for talks with Zelensky about negotiating an end to the war in Ukraine. That followed talks in Saudi Arabia a day earlier involving Secretary of State Marco Rubio and a delegation from Moscow. Israel says it will conduct forensic tests to identify the bodies of four Israeli hostages handed over by Hamas today. It's part of their ongoing ceasefire agreement. This is NPR News from Washington. The Vatican says blood tests indicate a slight improvement in the health of Pope Francis. He remains hospitalized in Rome for pneumonia in both lungs. A spokesman says the 88-year-old pontiff was able to get out of bed today and eat breakfast. Yesterday, Italy's premier, Giorgia Meloni, visited the Pope and said he was in good spirits. Inflation watchdogs at the Federal Reserve will be keeping close watch on President Trump's new tariff moves. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, minutes from the Fed's latest policy meeting show concerns about the tariffs sending prices higher.
Fed policymakers expect inflation will continue to cool towards their 2% target, but the path could be bumpy, and President Trump's plans to impose higher taxes on imports could make it harder to bring prices under control. Business contacts in a number of Fed districts say they'll try to pass the cost of any tariffs on to consumers. And a couple of Fed policymakers warned it may be hard to distinguish one-time price hikes caused by tariffs from more persistent inflationary pressures. The minutes are from the January meeting where the central bank held interest rates steady. Fed policymakers generally want to see more progress on inflation before they order any additional interest rate cuts. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Moments ago on Wall Street, stocks opened lower. The Dow was off 160 points. The S&P is down 14. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Elon Musk has been spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. He's appeared in interviews with President Trump in the Oval Office and has said he leads the Department of Government Efficiency although a White House legal filing denies that the presidential aide actually directs it. At the same time, Musk does lead businesses, including government contractors in other parts of the country, and these days, the heart of his personal empire is not California, but rural Texas. The Texas Newsroom's Lauren McGaughey went there.
There's no use in arguing. The city of Bastrop is dang cute. There's a quaint little main street, Victorian-era homes dot downtown like oversized gingerbread houses. The town salon is even called the best little hair house in Texas. It's mostly farms and ranches out here in Bastrop County, and the population has barely broken 100,000 for more than a century. That's why it's hard to believe that just outside of town is the economic epicenter of one of the world's richest people.
Elon Musk.
Yay, Mr. Musk is here. Yay, yay, yay.
Elon Musk. He's moved nearly all of his companies to Texas in the last few years, but nowhere is Musk's business power more concentrated than at his massive corporate compound in rural Bastrop County. Here, at a sprawling 600-acre site, you can find a SpaceX Starlink manufacturing facility, the home of Musk's tunneling firm, The Boring Company, and the Hyperloop Plaza, a mini-mart, bar, and playground for the public. Locals said Bastrop's rural identity is exactly why Musk chose this area to build. Bastrop is just a 45-minute drive from Austin, with its tech workforce and big city amenities, but it's largely unincorporated, meaning Musk is subject to fewer development and environmental rules. Paul Poppy was the county judge here until a few years ago. He says Bastrop County was ready for explosive growth. Elon Musk just lit the fuse.
He's a rare breed and brought a sort of a new energy to development in Bastrop.
According to legal filings and SpaceX company reports, Musk is expanding his presence in Bastrop County in 2025. He's going to double the size of his SpaceX facility here. The new headquarters for social media company X will open here soon. And then there's Snailbrook, a company town Musk wants to build here for his local employees. Bastrop City Manager Sylvia Carrillo Trevino thinks Snailbrook could be way bigger than previously projected. Thousands of homes instead of hundreds. Probably later this year, she says Snailbrook will tap into the local wastewater line, allowing it to further develop.
We're such a welcoming small town community. And then you add Elon to the mix, the, for lack of a better term, free advertising that we've gotten about him being in our midst, I think is the entire driver.
Carrillo Trevino estimates Bastrop will grow by 42% in the next 5 years. Fully half of that growth, she thinks, is due to Musk's influence.
If Elon thinks Bastrop is cool, it must be cool.
All of this growth means home prices here have gone up and traffic has gotten worse. Musk's businesses have also been fined for environmental violations. The area has resisted attempts to be annexed into the city of Austin, which is politically more liberal. And locals want to preserve Bastrop's idyllic rural environment and small-town culture. I met Rachel Tolbert on Main Street in Bastrop.
I live in the country, so I'm pretty unaffected by the changes personally, and hopefully it'll stay that way.
If Musk's plans for the area come to fruition, that may be wishful thinking. For better or worse, change is coming. For NPR, I'm Lauren McGaughey in Bastrop, Texas.
Hamas has released the bodies of what it says are four Israeli hostages back to Israel, including the body of a mother and her two young sons.
They will undergo forensic testing in Israel to confirm their identity. This is the first time that Hamas has released the bodies of hostages under the current ceasefire.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Kat. What, it must be a difficult day there.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty somber here.
So what can you tell us about the remains that were released? Who were they?
So Hamas says that they are the bodies of Shiri Bibas and her two young sons, Ariel and Kafir, as well as the body of 84-year-old Oded Lifshitz. All four of them were taken hostage in the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led attack on southern Israel. Shiri's husband, Yarden, was also taken hostage with the rest of the family on that day. The Bibas family had become a symbol here in Israel of the plight of the hostages in Gaza. The two children, ages 4 and 9 months when they were captured, were the youngest hostages taken. So Bibas had become this household name here. Posters of their faces were plastered on sidewalks, and commemorations had been held in the children's birthdays. Yarden, the dad, was released alive earlier this month. Oded Lifshitz, the other body released today, was a retired journalist and peace activist. His wife had also been taken hostage, but was released earlier in the war.
Do we know how they died?
Well, Hamas says all four were killed by Israeli strikes during their time in captivity in Gaza. Israel says it will take the bodies to an Israeli forensic institute here in Tel Aviv, which will examine them and provide official identification and also seek to determine the cause of death.
This is the first time that Hamas has handed over bodies during this war. The previous releases have been of hostages who were alive. So would you mind just describing the scene? Like, what was it like both in Gaza and in Israel? Was it different?
Yeah, it was definitely more somber and much less celebratory on both sides. In Gaza, large crowds gathered in Khan Yunis in the south. Masked Hamas gunmen presided over a ceremony on a stage with four coffins draped in black. There were large posters on both sides of the stage in Hebrew and English. One depicted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a fanged vampire. Another said that if Israel resumed the war, more hostages would come home in coffins. In Israel, unlike previous releases, the Hamas ceremony was not broadcast on Israeli TV, and Israeli media outlets did not publish images from it out of respect for the families. Once the caskets were in Israeli custody, they were then draped with Israeli flags, and then they were driven from Gaza to Tel Aviv, and large crowds gathered along the route to show solidarity and respect.
So you've obviously been following the ceasefire deal very closely. What's expected to happen next in the coming days and in the ceasefire deal?
Yeah, so Saturday is going to be a big day. The remaining six live hostages that Hamas has committed to releasing in this first phase will be released, including two have been held for around a decade, and they'll be released in exchange for more than 600 Palestinians released from Israeli jails. This first phase of the deal ends on March 2nd, and so far talks for the next phase haven't started yet. They were supposed to start weeks ago, so we're really just waiting to see what happens with that. You know, meanwhile, there still will be dozens of Israeli hostages in Gaza, around half of them are believed to be alive.
That is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
Later today on All Things Considered, they're going to talk about a story that's important back here in the United States. With measles outbreaks in several states, medical professionals say getting vaccinated is your best protection, but some adults who got the jab before 1968 may need a booster. Listen on your phone with the NPR app or via your smart speaker. Just ask for your local NPR member station by name. This is NPR News.
President Trump's new executive order promotes in vitro fertilization, but how will that sit with the supporters who oppose it? Next time, here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with Ancient History Breaking News. Egyptologists discovered the first tomb of an Egyptian pharaoh in a century, the first of its kind since they found King Tut's tomb. This one belonged to one of his ancestors, King Thutmose II, buried in a chamber where the ceiling painted with blue and yellow stars. After he died, his widow, Hatshepsut, became one of the few women ever to rule ancient Egypt. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. For the first time in years, an endangered bird is flying free in Hawaii. That's the sound of the alala, a rare crow that's only found in the Hawaiian Islands. The alala. Alala la 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 la. The bird went extinct in the wild in 2002 and has survived only in captivity since, until recently when a few were released in the forests of Maui. Here's NPR's Lauren Sommer.
Very few people have seen an alala because the only place they've existed is in a handful of buildings.
So the building that we just entered is one of our alala buildings.
Jennifer Pribble works at the Maui Bird Conservation Center. It's home to some of the rarest birds in the world, including the alala, which are kept in special enclosures. They're large black birds, and as a species of crow, they're very chatty.
So they have quite an extensive language.
These birds were brought into human care in the 1970s when it was clear they were on a path to extinction. The forests they relied on were disappearing. Invasive predators and disease also took a toll. So this facility is a last resort, an attempt to keep them on the planet by setting up a breeding program.
And so we've built the breeding program up from about 8 founders. So all the birds, all that exist in the world have 8 great-great-great-grandparents, basically.
Now, there are around 100 of them. These birds aren't the only animals in this situation. Hawaii has more endangered species than any other state. And more of them are being brought into captivity as a last-ditch effort to save them.
There's facilities for insects. There's facilities for plants. Like, everything that is native to Hawaii is threatened.
Getting these animals back into the wild is the goal. But it's not as simple as just setting them free. For one, the crows here have gotten used to human care, even though the staff tries not to interact with them. A small group of crows was released on Hawaii a few years ago, but many became prey for hawks. Now, they're trying another release on Maui, where there aren't any hawks, and they're starting with releasing 5 young crows.
So the birds that are going to be released are about a year old, so they haven't learned lots of bad behaviors. They're inquisitive. They're still learning things.
Then the big day came. The birds were sent off in a traditional ceremony from the native Hawaiian group Nahanona Kulikiopi'ilani. Alala are sacred in Hawaiian culture. Then they were loaded onto a helicopter to be released in a remote forest. So far, the birds are doing well.
It's extremely hopeful.
Hannah Mounts is the manager of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, which helped release the birds. She says they're getting to know their forest home.
It's like this teenage gang, and it's really funny to see how they interact with each other. And, you know, they help each other and hand each other food.
The crows are still getting some food from her team as they learn to find food for themselves. That's what's difficult when you bring animals into captivity, Mounts says. They have to learn to be wild again and still need human help. But it's a big step forward.
Conservation challenges in Hawaii are immense and complicated and difficult. So, you know, the fact that this release has actually happened and that these birds, at least for now, are doing extremely well is so exciting.
With so many of Hawaii's species in peril, she says every win is important. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. President Trump is moving to kill New York City's congestion pricing program. That's a daily toll for vehicles that enter Manhattan below 60th Street. During his campaign, he promised to end it, but Governor Kathy Hochul is vowing to fight him on it. Stephen Nesson from member station WNYC is following all this.
In a letter to the governor, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who once starred on the MTV TV show The Real World, writes, "The $9 daily toll for vehicles isn't fair to drivers, and the Biden administration should never have approved the congestion pricing program in the first place." Speaking at a news conference, Governor Kathy Hochul fired back.
"It's not the real world, Sean. It's real life for New Yorkers, and don't you forget that."
New York State spent 5 years studying congestion pricing, ensuring it would reduce traffic and comply with all federal laws, while also raising much-needed revenue for the ailing transit system. President Trump boasted on his social media site that, quote, "congestion pricing is dead, Manhattan and all of New York is saved, long live the king." Hochul had a response ready.
"New York hasn't labored under a king in over 250 years. And we sure as hell are not gonna start now."
The two leaders had planned to meet last week, but after Trump's Justice Department ordered the Southern District to drop federal corruption charges against Mayor Eric Adams, Hochul canceled the meeting. Anticipating that Trump would make good on his campaign pledge to kill the tolling program, which had been unpopular with residents of the Hudson Valley, Long Island, and parts of New Jersey, Hochul said the Metropolitan Transportation Authority was ready with a counter lawsuit to keep the toll program running. Keeping with the fighting theme, like Sly Stallone in the film Rambo, she says she's not backing down.
"Someone draws first blood, you respond."
Her response? The tolling cameras are staying on for now. But the final decision will now be up to a judge. Jack Lester is a lawyer who sued the MTA to halt the program and lost in federal court. He believes the Trump administration does have the authority to kill the tolls.
"The federal government has discretion to halt the program. It's not a mandatory program."
Since early January, when the tolls went into effect, traffic in the city has decreased by 9%. That works out to 1.2 million fewer vehicles, according to the MTA. And a recent poll finds 6 out of 10 New Yorkers don't want Trump to kill the tolls. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Nesson in New York.
Your car traveling at high speed on the ice sounds dangerous, but for dozens of drivers in central Minnesota, this is fun. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Gunderson talks about ice racing.
Some of the race cars rumbling on the ice of Bass Lake are dented and dirty. Some are smartly painted and recently washed. But they're all here on a cold Sunday afternoon for the same reason. Go as fast as they can on a half-mile oval ice track.
We're all out here having fun. We're pretty decent guys. Pretty much everybody here is volunteer. It's kind of a whole community thing. It's been that way for a long time.
This guy is the boss. He wears a green vest with Mr. Official emblazoned on the back.
My name's Dave Holmgren. We've been at ice racing here for 30 years or so.
30 years of racing here on Bass Lake. But Dave started ice racing in his 20s, 45 years ago.
Then I got my boy started into it.
My name is Jacob Holmgren, and I am 29. I've been at this for, I'd say, probably 15 years or better.
So what's the attraction?
Oh, going in circles, passing cars, doing some donuts. Then when you're all said and done, we pick up a nice hot dog and chips and drink, and it's just entertainment.
Dave Holmgren says this is pretty simple. It's about a bunch of people who love playing on the ice.
It's just a blast.
The ice racers do encourage passengers, and kids as young as 7 can race with parents' permission. There are different classes of cars. Cars with studded tires can hit 80 miles an hour on the ice track. Cars with normal tires might run in the 30s.
It probably ain't the fastest thing with the rubber tires, but I tell you what, you got good patience, you're at the right place at the right time, you can always wave your buddy when you go by.
15 minutes before racing starts, drivers gather around Mr. Official with the green vest.
Thanks for coming again. Now this is the third week. And we all know what happens in the third week. You animals eat some raw meat or some iron or something?
This is his way of telling the drivers to rein in aggressive driving.
We all need to enhance our calmness now, okay? We ain't running for Daytona money, so take it easy. So we can have some fun.
This isn't about the money. A driver who wins all the races in their class today might take home a whopping $15 in prize money. There are relatively few crashes, and most involve a car sliding into the snow berm surrounding the track.
There is some rubbing out here. There's a little bit of paint swapping. For the most part, everybody's pretty good about it. Might get one occasionally, might be a little upset, but we're all good. We all talk to one another.
When the racing starts, Jacob Holmgren tracks me down. He's carrying a helmet. It fits. So I jump in the passenger seat of his beat-up station wagon. The car has a heater, and it works. He rolls into position among 8 cars on the track.
We'll see how we go. Hopefully we do good.
There's a lot of bouncing and swaying and sliding and noise. The 8 laps pass quickly at speeds of 50 to 60 miles per hour. Jacob is pleased with his second place finish.
As soon as you get in a car, more or less, you're going to be hooked into ice racing. It's that simple.
Organizers say the sport is growing as more young drivers try the thrills and chills of racing on ice. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gunderson on Bass Lake.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, a Ukrainian activist and writer is thinking about the future, a future after the war against Russia. He says, in a time of peace, his home country should open up for investment in a certain way.
I think that human rights, and specifically labor rights, should be not only observed and respected, but developed, and this should be a precondition to any investment.
Governance in a post-war Ukraine. Listen tomorrow on your smart speaker, your phone, or on your radio, your public radio station, which brings you this program. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
When it rains 5 days and the skies turn dark at night. When it rains 5 days and the skies turn dark at night. Then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. able to make a